Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about most U.S. adults say that today's children have worse health than in past generations. University of Michigan has done that study. And from the National Institutes of Chemical and Pharmaceutical Research in Romania, the great willow herb as an antidote in therapies against multiple drug-resistant bacteria. That's a really important issue because hundreds of thousands of people are dying, tens of thousands in the United States each year because they get an infection and it doesn't heal. From the University of Southampton, United Kingdom, a study, cardiovascular safety of calcium and vitamin D. Yeah, they're safe. Lots of people, and they took a lot of vitamin D. Why is that important? Because there's some fear mongers and trolls who are trying to prevent people from taking supplements. Now, about every 6 months, just like clockwork, you'll see another attack on people wanting to do something that's good for them, taking power to make a choice in their diet. Oh, you don't want to eat a vegan diet, you'll die of, you know, B12 deficiency. Not true. So what we do is we try to show you that these rumors, unsubstantiated pseudoscientific statements, more often than not, behind them, you'll find big agra wanting to keep you taking their sugar, meat, eggs, and dairy, or big pharma. Today, Stanford University says that vitamin D deficiency, when you don't have enough, can promote the spread of some breast cancers. That's not good, but it is good if you take vitamin D. Now, we have a lot on health and healing every day, but also it is my belief that you cannot be healthy individually if you're not healthy also collectively. And we can. There's no reason we have to have epidemics, pandemics of diabetes in children and senior citizens who are so infirm and feeble that they can't even walk a block, and people losing their memory in their 40s and 50s and 60s, and an epidemic of brain disorders that are happening now and it's only going to get worse. So for that, it's more than diet, far more. It's the value of our belief systems, who we trust, who are our official policymakers, what information they give us. And so I'm going to go into that today. For example, I'm going to talk about a neurosurgeon saying in a public statement, okay, you vaccine zealots, why don't you try injecting yourself with all those shots you say children should get? And how many did Dr. Paul Offit, the leading advocate, pro-vaccine advocate, say? 10,000. Okay. He's saying, why don't you inject yourself with 10,000 vaccines all at once? After all, your leading choir master says it's good, no harm. Why don't you just try this? Why don't you just, don't worry about 10,000, just take the normal schedule and inject yourself. Better still, I think it would be interesting to see you take all those vaccines that you're going to put into an undifferentiated baby's immune system, squirt them into a teaspoon, and drink it down. You know, the mercury, the aluminum, the formaldehyde, which is embalming fluid. Let's see if you can do that. Here's something that's interesting. Baylor University. People pray for others. Most Americans pray for healing. More than one-fourth have practiced laying on of hands. Mumbo-jumbo, pseudoscience, a bunch of delusional people, unfortunately illiterate people from the South. No. No, the illiterate people are those who do not appreciate the power of faith and of energy. My own personal experience, I'll share this with you today. So for those of you who've been praying for yourself and others, you're doing the right thing. For those of you who've never prayed for anyone and wouldn't, that's your choice. And you have that. And no one criticizes you for it. So why should you be so angry at people who do have faith, and yet that's the way it works? And from Professor Henry Giroux, one of the great minds on the planet, Authoritarian Politics in the Age of Civic Illiteracy. I don't think I'll have time today except for a brief newsmaker update from Alan Phillips. Let's begin. We always start with something on health and healing. And the importance is that we need to realize that every choice we make has an outcome, has a consequence. And the consequence we want is healing. And here we found is the more you run, jog, power walk, the denser your bones will be. This is from University of Camilo Sella in University in Spain. Quote, Spanish researchers have analyzed the effect of endurance running training on the stiffness index in a variable that is directly related to bone quality. And the results confirm that the greater the distance you go in your training and your exercise, the greater the bone mineral density. So the older you get, the further you should actually be working out. You should be going for those nice long runs. That'll do you an enormous amount of good. And you'll have nice dense bones. Otherwise, you end up with porous bones because you're too sedentary. And the minerals such as calcium, magnesium, boron, phosphorus are not getting into the bone to create a strong matrix. So power walking, jogging, increase bone density. That's a good thing. Watercress, a wonderful, wonderful, tasty, little bitter, but otherwise delicious green, detoxifies carcinogens in smokers. This University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute, quote, watercress extract taken multiple times a day significantly inhibits the activation of tobacco-derived carcinogen in cigarette smokers. That's good. And that was presented at the American Association of Cancer Research's annual meeting. Now, imagine that. For at least 50 years, natural hygienists, those who practice a detoxification diet, have always advocated watercress and other bitters. And now we see the science is there to back it up. So take your watercress. Also, from London's Kingston University, eating dark chocolate every day could help boost athletic performance. Dark chocolate has always been held for its positive effects on cardiovascular health. And now a study undertaken at London's Kingston University has found that it also encourages additional stamina and strength right up there with beetroot juice. The two together are terrific for athletes to take. Quote, beetroot juice is rich in nitrates, which are converted to nitric oxide in the body. This dilates the blood vessels and reduces oxygen consumption, allowing athletes to go further for longer. Now, then they found out that chocolate does the same thing. And there's a specific nutrient in the chocolate. It's called EPA, E-P-I, catechin, C-A-T-E-C-H-I-N. That's a flavanol. And it's found in the cacao bean. And it also increases nitric oxide production. So, some healthy chocolate increases your heart capacity, your blood to carry oxygen and nutrients to the cells, increases your endurance and stamina. In fact, 4 weeks ago in a state championship, most of the athletes have some kind of liquid that they get during the race. They run by a table, they grab it, down it goes. I saw a lot of colas. I saw a lot of colas plus extra caffeine. I saw people opening up caffeine capsules and pouring it in there. One guy had I said, how much caffeine is there? He said, oh, I don't know, 1,000, 2,000 milligrams. I said, whoa, you could have a heart attack with that amount. So up comes mine, and I have 6 cups of beet juice with coconut water. And then I took the nutrients, coenzyme Q10 and vitamin E and tocotrienols and magnesium, all of which are important for your heart and your immune system. And they all did good, by the way. These are all great athletes. But I had energy throughout the whole race. You know, and it's what I absolutely advocate for any athlete. So now that knowing this, what I would do is I would simply take some chocolate, maybe 2 ounce pieces, and about every 2 miles I'd have another piece of chocolate. So that's something to look forward to. that you could also do as well. But there's another reason you should have chocolate. This is from the University of Maine and the University of South Australia. They said, quote, people who ate chocolate at least once a week perform better on multiple cognitive tasks compared to those who ate chocolate less frequently. And with age, and we don't have the same working memory, but this was able to increase visual spatial memory and organization, working memory, abstract verbal reasoning, scanning and tracking, all are part of cognitive function, all improved with chocolate. And that's important. So get your chocolate. And regular exercise may boost prostate cancer survival. So they looked at 10,000 men, 50 to 93 years of age, and they tracked them over a long period of time, about 12 years. They found that those who exercised regularly and had the highest level of exercise had a 30% increase they were in health and longevity, meaning they were less likely to die. And so that's important that you understand exercise makes all the difference in the world, and do it on a regular basis. Now, I'm looking at the clock. I gave you a whole lot of health information. I'll come back if I have time for more, but I want to get into some of the other things that are very important. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Let me just touch on a few more things in case people say, oh, I thought you were going to talk about the children. Yes, I will for just a moment, because that is important. More than half of adults believe children today are more stressed, experience less quality family time, and have worse mental and emotional health than children in past generations. And they're right. Quote, we have seen major advances in medicine, public health over the last century that have greatly reduced children's illness and death. On the other hand, conditions like childhood obesity, asthma, and behavior problems have become more common. Yeah, they have. Also, behind all this, a lack of quality parenting. You can't blame the obese baby and child and toddler and infant. You can't blame the hyperactive, not because of a brain chemical imbalance, child, and you're asking a school teacher to compete with what can hold that child's attention versus the stimulation over the internet or outside the classroom, unless you have a lot of input as a parent in a way that both guides and creates a sense of understanding that you're in school for a period of time, learn, respect the teacher, and have your fun outside of school. But when you're there, pay attention. And we haven't had that. What we've had is we've had everything relegated to someone else. Child development has become a service, outsourced service, and it doesn't work. Our parents raised us. We had discipline, we had manners, we had morals, we had ethics, unless we chose not to, and if we did, there was a consequence. Today, there's no consequence. So yeah, kids today are under stress, and adults are too. But we're not remedying any of the stress because we're not looking at the underlying cause, and we should. So they were right. Now, from the National Institutes of Chemical Pharmaceutical Research in Romania, the great willow herb can help if you have drug-resistant bacteria that could kill you. And this is just a weed, but a very powerful one, with a phenomenal reputation. It helps the prostate gland, it helps urinary tract, and tests confirm that combining some of the commonly used ingredients with the great willow herb extract, you can now treat fungal infections and bacterial infections that previously would not respond to antibiotics. How serious is it? 23,000 deaths just this year in the United States from people who got an infection more often than not in a hospital, and they couldn't stop it. Every antibiotic they used, it was resistant. But they didn't use a combination of willow and colloidal silver and colloidal gold and also Manuka honey. Had they done that, they would have all likelihood had a different outcome. In the United Kingdom, they did a study showing that contrary to any popular opinion or statements, calcium and vitamin D supplements at high doses, for example, they found that taking 34,890 individuals took calcium and vitamin D at high doses, no adverse effects, no negative effects on the heart at all. So it was just a bunch of scare tactics. And also from Stanford University, vitamin D deficiency promotes the spread of some breast cancer, which means that vitamin D in good amounts could help prevent the spread of breast cancer or even the development of breast cancer. Now, here is a statement as presented by Ethan Huff in Natural News, quote, Dr. Russell Blaylock, a neurosurgeon and author and an expert on excitotoxins, has issued a public challenge to vaccine pushers everywhere to put their money where their mouths are. He has stated the following. He has challenged Dr. Paul Offit, vaccine manufacturer, CEOs, and U.S. Center for Disease Control scientists, why don't you all take the same vaccines you're advocating on children? After all, it was Offit who said, quote, infants could safely get 100,000 vaccines at once. Really? Don't think so. We have an awful lot dying and getting sick with just one or two. 100,000, you're definitely going to be destroying a lot of life. So why don't we ask the doctors and nurses and pharmacists, why don't they take that entire protocol and let's see what the results are. One more reason to say no to the TTIP treaty. From Common Dreams, trade officials promised Exxon, we will erase environmental obstacles worldwide. Newly released documents show that in backroom talks, European officials assured ExxonMobil that the pending U.S.-European Union trade agreement would force removal of regulatory obstacles worldwide, thus opening them up even more countries to exploitation by the fossil fuel empire. So, behind closed doors, they were dealing out our environment, they were destroying regulations, and they were giving a giant gift to the biggest polluters in the world. And that's what's in your TTIP treaty. And that shouldn't be, but it is. One more reason to be against all these treaties. And their pesticides, we should be banning all commercial pesticides, all of them. They're all dangerous. Quote from The Guardian, widely used pesticides can kill frogs within an hour. New research reveals, suggesting the chemicals are playing a significant and previously unknown role in the catastrophic global decline of amphibians. The scientist behind the study said it was both, quote, astonishing and alarming that common pesticides could be so toxic at doses approved by regulatory authorities, adding to a growing criticism of how pesticides are tested. Quote, you would not think products registered on the market would have such toxic effects. It is the simplest effect you can think of. You spray the amphibian with the pesticide, and it is dead. That should translate into a dramatic effect on populations. Yes, it should, but also remember the amphibians are dying, the birds are dying, and they eat insects. So as you kill off birds and frogs and amphibians, you're killing off a major balance in the universe when it comes to stopping the massive amount of insects that could harm us. And this is important as well. Let me read this. This is from Baylor University. Quote, nearly 9 of 10 Americans have relied upon healing prayer at some point in their lives, praying for others even more than for themselves. Quote, the most surprising finding is that more than a quarter of all Americans have practiced laying on of hands. Nearly 1 in 5 has done so on multiple occasions, said Dr. Jeff Levin, the University Professor of Epidemiology and Population Health and Director of the Program on Religion and Population Health at Baylor's Institute of Studies of Religion. Quote, outside of the belief of God, there may be no more ubiquitous religious expression in the U.S. than the use of healing prayer. And this was published in the Journal of Religion and Health. My thoughts on this. Back in the 1970s, I wanted to try an experiment at the Institute of Applied Biology, where I was a research scientist. I went to the director and I told him what the experiment would be, and he thought it was nonsense. And he said, I cannot bring that up to the board, because if I did, and there's a group of 16 different department scientists, they would not approve it, and they would just think it's nuts. They already don't think that anything you do with nutrition has any impact upon the body, so I cannot approve it. I said, okay, well, but at the same time, you don't approve it, you're not preventing me. He says, well, just don't tell me anything about it. I said, fine. So I put out the word, and it took about 6 months, and I said, do any people out there believe that they have the power to influence the outcome of cancer? And I was flooded with responses. And we narrowed it down to 50 people. And some you've probably heard of, Catherine Coleman, Ogle Worrell, Dr. Harry Edwards, who headed the Spiritual Association of Great Britain, and one person is head of nursing at New York University Medical School, Dolores Krieger, and Rabbi Abraham Wiseman, Dr. Thomas Kruth, the Order of St. Luke, and as well as Audrey Carger, Dr. Audrey Carger. And we brought them in, and what I did was I knew a Dr. Sugiera over at Sloan Kettering, and I managed to get some mice that only lived a very short period of time. And the idea was that you could do whatever energy exchange you wanted, but there had to be a monitor there so there wouldn't be any switching of animals, no games. And so there were two monitors. Every time they came in, they would sit down, generally from 15 minutes to a half hour. They would do prayer, and you could hear them. They were praying, or sometimes they didn't pray in openly, but you could look at their expression on their face, and their hands were cupped around. And at times, with certain people, you could actually feel the energy. I mean, it was palpable, the energy. So at the end of the first experiment, five of the individuals were able to create a phenomena. Now, with one time, you only have a phenomena. That in and of itself is not proof. And then the rest of the people were not able to do that, and they were excluded. So over a period of 2 years, we reproduced this experiment six times. And all six times, each of these people were able to heal their mouse. I then wanted to see, because the universe doesn't deal in half-truths, so if a person could influence a mouse that has cancer, shouldn't it also be able to heal a plant or help a sprout grow? So we had a lead-lined room, and in one half we had sprouts, that identical sprouts, water, lighting, identical, soil identical, but in one room, a group would do their healing, and sure enough, with time-lapse photography, the group that was praying over the sprouts had just shot up. Incredible. And then we would cut enzymes, and these people could reconnect the enzymes. And one of the most unique things was there was a ficus plant that I brought in, and I gave each one of the people a message on a piece of paper. And no one knew what messages were. They were not talking with each other, and they weren't sharing any of this. So one would go in and miss the plant and sing to it. Another would go in and put on classical music and meditate with it. But one of them was to go in there and yell at the plant and shake it and pull off one of the leaves. 6 months later, they all came back, and we hooked an EEG machine up to the plant's roots. As each one went in, you saw the plant responding to it, and when one of the persons went in, the needle just went off the chart. And it was the one that had yelled and pulled off the plant and shook it. The plant recognized the person. Now, this may seem extremely esoteric or just a whim, but it wasn't. It was a long 3-year experiment, and what it meant was that for the first time scientifically, under strict, rigid scientific principles, we could prove that energy was exchanged. And the whole idea that energy is exchanged, going back to the same principle, I then did 2 more years of research showing that food has energy. Some food has no energy. And therefore, the more processed the food, the dead energy food like meat. But then you also have live energy food. And the highest level of living energy in food were the juices, raw organic juices. And then behind that, sprouted foods and sprouts. And then I found that the healing capacity was at 8, 9, and 10. So as long as you had a person on a diet of foods that registered 8, 9, and 10 in their capacity to heal, you got your greatest results. Then I transferred that knowledge over to a dietary program at Trafalgar Hospital with some stunning results. And then that's the diet I've been using ever since. So here we have people, and I used to watch my mother do this. When people would come, she was called a sensitive. And in the South, a sensitive is a person that has some unique energies. Just sits and holds people's hand, and very pleasantly, and every night of my life, I would watch people come to my little home, and my mom would sit there and smile and sharing her energy. My mother's funeral, there were one of the largest funerals, and she was just a very simple woman, very, very plain, but I can never remember saying and ever hearing her say a negative thing about anyone in her life. And we have to appreciate that beyond the very reductionistic mindset of the paradigm of medicine or public health, we have forgotten what is essential, that all disease, all happiness, all healing, all destruction is based upon the constructive or destructive power of energy. And when we bring back healing energy and we respect the power of prayer, and then we understand that we're connecting to something more than that limited monotheistic paradigm. So for those of you who have used prayer, and those of you who believe that faith is a very important part of your life, good for you. For those who don't, that's fine. No one's trying to convince you otherwise. But it's always been a one-sided argument. Those who do something that's unique are the ones who are disdained, and those who don't are the ones who feel they have the right to mock or ridicule other people. Not the best of choices. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I believe. Nice to have you with us, everyone. We're going to go to our guest, newsmaker Alan Phillips, talking about the horrendous vaccine bills in the New York State Legislature and why we must challenge it. But before that, I believe that we should stimulate ourselves at a level of understanding what is really occurring. Almost everything that I am exposed to is official dogma. Someone believes that what they are saying or doing or implementing, a war in Iraq, a war in Afghanistan, the invasion of Libya, the invasion of Syria, the coup in Honduras under Hillary Clinton, the coup in Russia under Hillary Clinton and Nuland of the State Department, all neocons, that it's the right thing to do. And because they control the media lets you know that it's the right thing to do. And because they control the think tanks, the most corrupt, I wouldn't say corrupt, but the most banal that I could imagine would be the Council on Foreign Relations, because it's from these unelected individuals who are self-appointed into a small group of maybe 5,000 people that virtually all of our foreign and issues are decided. And I'm wondering, why aren't they being challenged? Well, part of why these people are not challenged, the think tanks are not challenged, the messages that are packaged and processed and pasteurized out of the media are not challenged, because we're engaged in a race to the line of illiteracy. What do I mean? The dark times that haunt the current age are epitomized by the monsters that have come to rule the United States and who now dominate the major political parties and other commanding political and economic institutions. Their nightmarish reign of misery and violence and disposability is also evident in their dominance of a formative culture and its attendant cultural apparatuses that produce a vast machinery of manufactured consent. This is a social formation that extends from the mainstream broadcast media and internet to the print media and the print culture, all of which embrace the spectacle of violence, legitimate opinions over facts, and revel in a celebrity and consumer culture of ignorance and theatrics. Under the reign of this normalized ideological architecture of alleged common sense, literacy is now regarded as disdainful. Words are reduced to data, and real science is confused with pseudoscience. Thinking is now regarded as an act of stupidity, and ignorance is now a virtue. All traces of critical thought appear only at the margins of the culture as ignorance becomes the primary organizing principle of American society. For instance, 2/3 of American public believe that creationism should be taught in schools, and most of the Republican Party do not believe that climate change is caused by human activity, making the U.S. the laughingstock of the world. Politicians endlessly lie, knowing that the public is addicted to shocks, which allows them to drown in overstimulation and live in an over-accelerated overflow of information and images. News has become entertainment and echoes reality rather than integrating it. Unsurprisingly, education in the larger culture has become a distant imagination machine, a tool for legitimating ignorance. And it's the central to the formation of an authoritarian politics that has gutted any vestige of democracy from the ideology, policies, and institutions that now control American society. I'm not talking simply about the kind of anti-intellectualism that theorists such as Richard Hofstadter, Ed Herman, or Noam Chomsky, and more recently Susan Jacoby have documented, however insightful their analysis might be. I'm pointing to a more lethal form of illiteracy that is often ignored. Illiteracy is now a scourge and a political tool designed primarily to make war on language, meaning, and thinking, and the capacity for critical thought. Chris Hedges, who you've heard many times on this program, is right in stating that the emptiness of language is a gift to demagogues and the corporations that saturate the landscape with manipulated images and the idiom of mass culture. The new form of illiteracy does not simply constitute an absence of learning and ideas or knowledge, nor can it be solely attributed to what has been called the smartphone society, the younger generation, that offers no critical thought to anything. On the contrary, it is a willful practice and a goal used to actively control the people and make them complicit with the forces that impose misery and suffering upon their lives. Gore Vidal once called America the United States of Amnesia. The title should be extended to the United States of Amnesia and Willful Illiteracy. Illiteracy no longer simply marks populations immersed in poverty with less access to quality education, nor does it only suggest the lack of proficient skills enabling people to read and write with a degree of understanding and fluency. More profoundly, illiteracy is also about what it means not to be able to act from a position of thoughtfulness, informed judgment, and critical agency. Illiteracy has become a form of political repression that discourages a culture of questioning, renders agency as an act of intervention inoperable, and restages power as a mode of domination. It is precisely this mode of illiteracy that now constitutes the modus operandi of a society that both privatizes and kills the imagination by poisoning with falsehoods, consumer fantasies, data loops, and the need for instant gratification. This is a mode of manufactured illiteracy and education that has no language for relating the self to public life and social responsibility or the demands of citizenship. It is important to recognize that the rise of this new mode of illiteracy is not simply about the failure of public and higher education to create critical and active citizens. It is about a society that eliminates those public spheres that make thinking possible while imposing a culture of fear in which there is the looming threat that anyone who holds power accountable will be punished. At stake here is not only the crisis of a democracy society, but a crisis of memory, ethics, and agency. As Professor Henry Giroux has so intuitively outlined, evidence of such a repressive society is visible in the growth of surveillance state. Every single phone call, every single email, every electronic communication, even when you're talking in your car, you're being monitored. When you're sitting at home watching one of the new televisions, the television is watching you and listening to you. Yes, even your cell phone, when you turn it off, unless you remove the batteries, it is capable of listening. And so today we have with us all suppression of dissent. We have the complete surveillance state, especially against black youth. The elimination of tenure in states such as Wisconsin, the rise of the punishing state, the militarization of the police. It is also evident in the demonization and the punishing and the war waged by the Obama administration on whistleblowers like Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning and Jeffrey Sterling, among others. Any viable attempt at developing a radical politics must begin to address the role of education and civic literacy and what I have termed public power. We have to take it back. Just some thoughts. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome our guest now from Asheville, North Carolina, Alan Phillips. Alan is one of the few lawyers in America and nationally recognized expert practicing vaccine exemption and waiver law and individual legal rights on vaccine policy. He advises families and individuals, attorneys and legislators across the U.S. on vaccine policies and health rights and exemptions. And he is an advisory board member of the World Association of Vaccine Education and co-founder of the North Carolina Citizens for Health Care Freedom. He also writes on these issues, and he has written an e-book called The Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions, and he also hosts the weekly radio show, The Vaccine Agenda. And for more information, you can go to his website, vaccinerights.com. Nice to have you with us today, Alan.
Pleasure and honor to be here with you today, Gary.
Alan, there are currently a few vaccination bills in the New York State Legislature. And in the State Assembly, there is Bill A-8329. And in the State Senate, there is Bill S-6017. These bills would remove religious exemption and also mandate federal recommended vaccines. And earlier, we realized that there are similar bills in almost all the different states, and they also... California's recent vaccine bills. However, you've commented that these New York bills are worse for families who refuse to vaccinate their children and for those who already have vaccine exemptions. Since you keenly monitor all the vaccines bills around the country, please explain to us why we should be especially worried about these New York bills and what ways can we challenge them.
Well, first, Gary, I think I want to point out that while, of course, this issue fundamentally is a medical and scientific issue, are vaccines safe, are they effective, are they necessary, are there effective alternatives, and so forth, the way this plays out in our daily lives is really predominantly a legal issue. At the end of the day, any place where a vaccine is required or any time a vaccine is required, there is either a law that says you can opt out or there isn't. So we had a real disaster happen recently in California where they passed a new law modifying the exemption law there that is now phasing out the non-medical exemptions to vaccines required for school and daycare enrollment. And I see New York State right now as the primary battleground state because they're trying to do the same thing now with this bill that you just mentioned, and there are a good 10 or more vaccine bills in New York, and several of them, if not all of them, look very problematic to me. But I think the key one and the most important one is the one you just mentioned, to remove the religious exemption, leaving only a medical exemption in place. And I don't know what the current medical exemption in New York looks like, but in general, medical exemptions are pretty hard to get. So this would, you know, pull out a whole category. Now, there's a separate question, which I don't think, frankly, is clearly resolved in the law at this point as to whether or not states may be required to offer religious exemptions. I don't think the federal constitution requires non-medical exemptions, but I think some state constitutions may. And this is a battle that has not yet occurred in the courts, so we really don't have a definitive answer to these questions yet. But I think if New York goes down, if they remove the religious exemption in New York, having now already done that with the religious and philosophical or personal belief exemptions in California, I think that would create not only, of course, a problem for anyone in New York who wants to legally opt out of vaccines, but I think that creates a backdrop where we could see this rapidly spread across states throughout the country. So I think it is particularly critical, not only for New Yorkers, but for the whole country, that we become legislatively active, legislatively involved, and oppose this bill in particular and some other ones that look pretty serious in New York right now, too.
Do you have any evidence of Big Pharma or the CDC support behind these bills, and particularly its sponsors, Assemblyman Dinowitz and Senator Holloman? And Dinowitz seems to be just excessively pro-vaccine and has called parents stupid if they don't believe in forced vaccinations. And then I heard that Assemblywoman Amy Paulin, who is supporting Assembly Bill 8329, had to testify in unrelated corruption trial that she and her husband own $150,000 Merck stock and are positioned to benefit financially from that legislation if passed. Any of that true? And any other corporate influence that, in, like Alec, that we can show are behind these bills, as we prove that they were behind the bills in California?
I don't have any details on that level, but I will say that what I observe nationally in this arena and in the larger vaccine controversy, just in a more general terms, is that what's being utilized here is not information. Again, we could certainly say fundamentally this is a scientific issue, and ultimately that's about the science and information. But as people are generally aware of the world of politics, again, just in sort of general terms, that people say whatever they need to say to get elected and then do whatever they do once elected, and often quite the opposite of what they promised to do, whether that was deliberate on their part or they just get elected and realize they can't do what they want to do. But there are techniques, psychological techniques being employed. Propaganda, for example, is not merely misinformation, but it's misinformation coupled with fear or some other emotional component that literally creates a barrier that prevents people from getting past the whatever the fear is, fear of infectious disease, getting sick or dying from an infectious disease. Whether or not the fear is legitimate or to what degree, a separate question. Once you trigger that fear, then you have a greater degree of control over that person's thinking and behavior, for example. So when people in the alternative vaccine movement go out on Facebook or the Internet and start having conversations, you don't see people in the pro-vaccine side coming back saying, well, here's the study that I'm using to back my view. You see them attack the person emotionally. One really laughable example that happened when I posted a whole list of studies once, and I try to stay off the Internet because I find it, in this respect, because I find it not a particularly productive use of my time much of the time. But the response was not, I disagree with your studies, here's my studies. The response was, I can't believe an attorney would argue this. There's something to that effect. In other words, attacking me personally. And that can sometimes be a real effective tool, psychological tool, for having a cooling effect, so to speak, of those who might otherwise speak out in support an alternative or anti-vaccine view. And when people are accused of being stupid, for example, as you just suggest, maybe the person saying that really means that because they're just completely ignorant of the subject. But maybe they are deliberately employing a psychological technique to try to shut out the other side. And as you know, Gary, I'm sure perhaps many times in the past you have invited people on the other side of the issue, for example, to debate the issue. And I was even scheduled to debate a pediatrician on radio a few months ago, and she backed out at the last minute because, according to her, I wasn't qualified to have the debate, and yet the debate was actually a legal question and not even a medical question. So I just had to laugh at that. They won't debate us. Because they'll lose.
They won't debate us. Every single time there's been a debate where those of us who are knowledgeable, who've spent over 10,000 hours of research, who've written critical articles that are scholarly and fully footnoted, they would not stand a chance in debate because we have the real science on our side. They have manufactured pseudoscience. They have corporatized science, and we can drive a truck through it. So they simply use the media to say, well, you're not qualified, or you're not this, you're not that. And yet, we bring in the toxicologists, the immunologists who are qualified, and they say the same thing. There is no such thing as a safe and effective vaccine based upon every single person taking it, and yet that's what they want us to believe. Because they're not saying only some people should take a vaccine and only this vaccine, and then be tested to see that there's no harmful effects and that the antibodies are actually protective. They've never done that. They have no good science on their side. It is the biggest public fraud in history, and sooner or later, more and more people are going to understand that, including Bernie Sanders, but not at this moment. Alan, thank you for being on for the Newsmaker Update. Alan is an attorney. His website is vaccinerights.com, vaccinerights.com. His ebook is The Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions. And Alan, today, since vaxxed, and I'm happy to see it's getting so much attention, everything they thought would not happen has not only happened by banning it, but giving it a whole national educational forum. But we are today asking people to go to progressiveradionetwork.com and download and watch Autism Made in the USA. Because remember, everyone in the movement back is pro-vaccine. Not the ones in, they're far more educated in, and Autism Made in the USA and the silent epidemic. Either of those two, watch them, share them with people. Let's get the word out. Thank you, Alan. And let your state legislators say no to mandatory vaccines. No to mandatory vaccines. Now, we're up at the end of our program. One last thing. We could use one or two volunteers in the office helping the coordination of this huge health support group I have starting the second week of June. So if you can help out, please call Bianca in our office. She'd be welcoming whatever help you could give, making phone calls. For everyone else, here's the deal. If you have anyone, yourself included, who would like to see what they could do with lifestyle and behavior to help your brain with dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, and depression, we're going to work on that in ways never before shared with brand new protocols. I'm going to be there personally every other Saturday for 3 hours on the Upper West Side, and we're going to keep diaries. We're going to have before and after. We're going to bring in experts. It's going to be wonderful. I believe of the 43 different support groups I've done in the last 35 years, this by far will be the most effective. And for people who want help, this is it. Call 646-926-5422. Have a nice day, everyone.